Art is a great place to sit within the theology of glory. We want strong figures, we want virtuous heroes. But the history of modern art, to my mind, it's counter to the theology of glory. It starts with pain and suffering. Edvard Munch, who painted The Scream, was asked about where art comes from, and he said, art comes from joy and pain. And then he said, but mostly from pain. And I think that's the human experience, and I think modern art reflects that.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. We have the privilege of talking to a friend. Dr. Dan Seidel has spent over 15 years as an art museum curator, art critic, and college art history professor with a specialization in the history of modern art. And he's worked with numerous contemporary artists on exhibition and publishing projects. He's the author of God in the Gallery, A Christian Embrace of Modern Art, published by Baker Academic in 2008. His article, Hearing the Scream, appears in a recent issue of Modern Reformation. Dan, thanks for being with us on the White Horse Inn.
It's my pleasure.
First of all, the most basic question, what is art? How does it fit in culture?
The question, what is art, is something I've been pursuing for 15 to 20 years. I'm not exactly certain what the answer is. It's the pursuit that has truly interested me. But there is something interesting, compelling going on when a person uses material and creates an artifact, and their beliefs, their intentions, their emotions somehow and in some way are infused in that material. And art is a particular way of expressing, embodying our human experience.
We tend, especially these days in our culture, to reduce culture primarily to politics and ideas. And so art fits into that by illustrating or expressing or decorating, oftentimes even propaganda. Is art more than this? Is the purpose of art to do more than to inspire us, to illustrate ideas, to express our inner feelings, or to decorate things?
I think so. I think what art does is it slows that down. Our human desire to use the world for our purposes, to
as make consumers.
To make it reflect what we already think we know about the world. And my experience working with artists and looking at paintings and sculptures and works of art seems to give me evidence that really artists are involved in trying to discover something about themselves and about the world. And when they do that, they are, whether they believe in God or have religious or spiritual inclinations, they're moving in those directions, and it opens up a very interesting theological space to think about who we are as human beings. But there is a sense, the desire is to use art to reflect what we already believe about the world.
Religion is probably the closest kin to art. Art has always been associated with religion, which is why perhaps historically many Christians and Jews have been, as well as Muslims, have been suspicious of art because of its association with idolatry. How should Christians engage with the arts?
Well, on one hand, I think one way that Christians can engage it is by embracing our freedom in Christ, our freedom to be able to appreciate and take seriously the work of human beings. And art is a particular kind of cultural work. It has a history and a tradition. And I think we are free to explore that and to appreciate it, to study it, and to allow it to help us experience and think about what it means to be a human being, to live in relationship to our neighbor, to live in relationship to the creation and to God. I also think there's a tendency to make art do perhaps too much, to make it communicate a particular message, and then we're frustrated because a painting doesn't declare itself as clearly and as directly as we want other messages in the world. And the fact that art doesn't communicate that way is its value, I think.
What are some of the wrong turns that Christians can take at that point in, quote-unquote, interpreting art, especially if you're looking for art to express a particular worldview, and we get frustrated if we can't discern from that piece the worldview. It's almost as if the painting itself or the sculpture is a package that we have to unwrap so that we can get inside the head of the artist's worldview.
That's exactly right. In my experience, and it seems counterintuitive, but my experience is it's not that way at all. An artist doesn't have something in that package. The package is the message. It is the experience. And we want to unwrap it to get at some idea
what's
or
behind
a
that instead
That's right.
of what is it.
That's right. And the artist has beliefs. Some of them are formulated. Some of them are not. Some of them are just feelings and intuitions. But when that artist creates a work, that work itself has its own identity, and it separates itself from the artist. So an artist may not have a kind of spiritual content or a spiritual or faith commitment, but the work can say something, and it can speak in a way that's different than the artist. And for me, that's the value of a Christian critic and a Christian viewer, because we can hear it. We can listen to the work and know and perhaps experience that there is something else going on, even if the artist, him or herself, isn't a confessing believer.
So art doesn't have to be a window into the soul of the artist. It sort of is its own entity. We're looking not through the art, but at the art, in order to sort of engage it rather than something behind it.
And that's what makes a work of art so interesting to me. A human being takes his or her experience, everything they've read, they've felt, they're looking at, just their entire human experience, and they make an artifact. They make a painting or they make a sculpture. And then that in itself is a product of it, but it's not defined by, limited by what the artist knows or feels, and in part because the artist doesn't know what he or she feels. Mm-hmm. They make a work of art not to express what they know already, but to find something else out about the world.
As Michael Polanyi says, we know more than we can tell.
Yes, absolutely.
One of the things that I found really interesting about your insights is that the Word of God opens us up to seeing things differently. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Sure. We often pit the Word against the image. And in many ways, we are very overly concerned about how things appear to us. And one of the things that I think focusing upon the Word, and particularly the reformational heritage that we have of the Word that's life-giving, is that it opens our senses. It opens our sight. It opens our tongue. We can speak once we're able to hear, and we hear the Word that is life-giving. So I've been very much interested in looking at works of art that might offend us visually, that don't quite appear to be art, or might not look like the way we want art to look like, and to develop ways to think about how we can listen to that work and to allow the work to speak to us, perhaps through or in spite of what we're seeing. And certainly within the history of modern art, the paintings and sculptures don't really look like traditional Renaissance, Baroque paintings and sculptures.
They're not representational.
They're not representational in a way intuitively that we would say is humanistic or glorifying or providing respect to the human being. And so we feel that a human figure has to look a particular way for it to be God-honoring. And in the history of modern art, you have figures that don't look like figures. They are distorted, or that looks like the artist doesn't know how to draw or to paint.
So distortion and disfiguring, that is something that our theology can actually account for.
It should be able to account for. It does account for, but we don't allow it. We don't apply it. Art is a great place to sit within the theology of glory. We want strong figures. We want virtuous heroes doing remarkable, wondrous things. And we want art to decorate, to make us look powerful, rich, wealthy. But the history of modern art, to my mind, it's counter to the theology of glory. It starts with pain and suffering. A Norwegian painter, Edvard Munch, who painted a very well-known painting called The Scream, was asked about where art comes from, and he said, art comes from joy and pain. And then he said, but mostly from pain. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the human experience, and I think modern art reflects that.
One of the points that you have made that has really stuck with me is the goal of the piece is to make you change your life. Can you go into that a little bit?
Oh, sure. The poet Rilke wrote a poem about his encounter with a classical Greek statue. And in his encounter with it, the sculpture speaks. And the sculpture says, you must change your life. And that quote to me, I've been doing a lot of thinking about, and thinking about how exactly a painting or a work of art speaks and what kind of claim it makes on us and how it speaks to us. So one of the things that we as Christians are often trained to do is we see art as symbolic of other ideas and trends and other kinds of indices for cultural climate. But really what high art does is that it roots you out of the crowd and it speaks to you. And with my experience working in a museum, I've become very sensitive to what actually happens when you look at a painting and think about it from the perspective not that I, as the viewer, have control, but that the painting is actually doing something to me and that it's approaching me and it's inviting me and making a claim that I need to examine myself. And as a Christians, we can think about that in relationship to our neighbor. We can think about it in relationship to God. And we often think about ourselves collectively. And I think high art isolates us in a very good way, forcing us to confront who we are standing before that painting painted by that artist 150 years ago, in which at that moment, I'm his or her audience. And that somehow in that relationship, at that moment, that painting is doing something to me. And that sense of that moment of passivity where we're receptive, I think is fraught with tremendous theological implications.
And it's so different from approaching culture generally as consumers, which, you know, is so common for us. How can I use this? How can I make sense of it? How can I do something with it? Rather than, what is it doing to me?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that might separate high art from popular art forms is that the audience for high art forms is often in the future. There's a certain kind of an eschatological assumption that I, as a painter, am making paintings for someone else, not just for the person down the street. So when we think about, say, the popularity of YouTube, a YouTube video will get 2 million hits in a certain span of time, but then it's gone and forgotten, and nobody remembers it. One of the interesting aspects of artistic practice is that the audience accumulates over time. It may just be a handful of people over time, but that handful of people continues. They span the moment, and you begin to have an audience that's built up over centuries. And that, from a theological perspective, that interests me about high art practices in which the artist has a sense that their audience is yet to come in some way. And it doesn't have to be an overly romantic kind of Van Gogh sense of the tortured artist, but just a sense that I'm making this work and it probably isn't going to sell. It's not just about moving inventory. Hmm. It's not just about making a painting and then selling it as a gauge for its value. So as Christians, we often think about culture in those consumer terms.
What's it worth?
And an artist that sells this kind of work or sells a lot of work or is successful financially is presumed to be good. And high art and the history of modern art particularly shows you that that's just not the case. What is good may unfold over time. And as a critic, I'm less interested in pronouncing whether a painting or an artist's work is good or not, and more concerned with creating space that it can unfold and not be condemned or praised too quickly, but there's just enough space for it to be understood. And then perhaps over time, it may become good.
So art not only has a past, it has a future.
Absolutely.
You've talked about the distinction between high art and popular art in an era especially of so much consumerism, or even high art, is treated as a commodity. How would you distinguish high art from entertainment? It seems like entertainment is just sucking up everything in its path, that sports is no longer sports, it's entertainment, that even religion is entertainment. Everything that is interesting or valuable as a human pursuit is being colonized by entertainment.
I think one of the key distinctions between fine art and entertainment is the sense of a future. Entertainment transacts the present. It doesn't really have a memory, and it doesn't really care what's happening, what's going to happen in the future. It's that particular moment. What do you want at this particular moment? And will provide you with that satisfaction. And I think with high art practices, the history of that practice is important, which also means that high art has to be learned, and it's an acquired taste, and it's an acquired taste because it goes against the grain of our kind of consumerist desire simply to be met where we are, rather than being urged on to, for us to get someplace else, so that that painting that we see or that piece of music that we hear actually is meaningful to us.
Which is the way we talk about scripture, that you can't go to the Bible asking your questions because they're trivial.
Right.
At least most of them are. You have to go to the scriptures letting them give you not only answers to your questions, but new questions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the sense also that high culture is future-oriented also. What high culture does is that it receives from the past and it passes on to the future. And that connection between the past and the future is crucial for high culture practices. Whether those high cultural practices are traditional or more avant-garde, it establishes that connection between a past and a future through the present expression. And in a culture in which we live eternally in today's, with no sense of yesterday and tomorrow, I think that value of thinking about the past and the future in relationship to the present, which is crucial to understanding high art, is crucial for us as human beings and as Christians in the church, in which we go to church and it's not just to feed our desires at the moment. We're connecting with the past and we're also looking forward to the future.
And in the process, becoming new people.
Absolutely.
As a result. It sounds like from what you're saying, there is a place for entertainment, to be entertained in the sense that we actually are acted upon by this work in a way that takes us out of ourselves and does entertain us, as you could even say a good sermon should do. But it's not entertainment as the objective. It's a byproduct of something greater, more profound going on.
That's right. And I think it's important to keep some distinctions, or even though the lines are are blurred, and I would say that the contemporary art world has been overrun by entertainment. It's modeling itself on an entertainment model. And so some of the work that I do in the larger art world is to try to recover its memory of what it is as something that isn't just oriented towards sales and spectacle, fame.
Something more than an art show.
It's absolutely right. Something more than an art show. But I think it's important to keep those distinctions. And if we come to a painting with entertainment categories, the painting's going to lose every single time, and it's not going to reveal itself to us.
That raises the question, what's going to happen to our ability, in your view, to be changed by these works of art when we are so addicted to gadgets, to digital technology? Is a trip to an art museum, for example, a great opportunity for us to put the gadgets away and instead of being actors, be acted upon and to just quietly be in front of something that we didn't create or initiate?
I think that's right. And there are so many different ways to approach, say, the practice of going to an art museum. There just isn't one way, and that you have to follow these kinds of rules to, quote-unquote, get something out of an art museum. I'm often critical of the desire or the expectation that when we go to an art museum, we need to be educated. There's something more than that. It's something that's less programmed. I mean, for me, the question, what is art, is a question that I've been thinking about for over 20 years, and my experiences with particular paintings all over the world are part of that relationship. And so the relationship, as I'm thinking about what art is, I have these instances, these moments where I've been encountered by this painting or that sculpture, or this photograph, and I've continued to think about it and been nourished by it. And I think that also is an interesting distinction with fine art practices where that the experience of it remains. And I'm thinking and presume that Rilke's poem in which that sculpture speaks, "You must change your life," is something that he hears in his mind over years as well, that it continues to speak to him and it still sits there and it gestates. And the more he learns and the more he's experienced about life and the more he's seen other works of art, that work gains strength. And I think in our entertainment framework, it's disposable. We forget about what the popular YouTube video was, or we forget, we can't even tell you the movies we've seen this past year. We've just done it and discarded it. And I think as Christians looking at culture, we do a lot of, oh, this painting in this museum or this gallery show tells us about those people out there. And I think one of the important things about high art is that it the finger is pointed at us. Mm. We're the problem. I'm saved by grace, but I'm still the problem. I'm still a sinner. And fine art in whatever medium, poetry, painting, music, I need to be reminded of that. And within that context, that's where beauty comes. I mean, what is most beautiful is the beaten body of a criminal hanging on a cross. And that undermines every human assumption we have about what is beautiful.
Redefines beauty and
absolutely
power. Modern art's often dismissed as, and not just in Christian circles, but generally, as unintelligible, elitist. The decadence of modern art, how we have wandered from that great Renaissance vision. You've made this the focus of your study over many years, modern art. Can you give us some concrete examples of modern artists we may know but sort of shy away from and help us understand what they're up to?
Sure. One of the key aspects of the history of modern art is for the first time, artists are bringing into the studio and their workshop their concerns, their struggles, the pain and their and suffering and their aspirations, and they're using their work to work through that. A Renaissance artist, as a human being, has struggles, but those emotional struggles aren't brought to the workshop or brought to the studio in the same way in which the paintings or the sculptures are outgrowths of that exploration.
You really wouldn't know what Raphael was struggling with at that period in his life to look at one of his great Renaissance paintings.
Exactly. He's fulfilling a commission, and he has particular things he has to deal with in that commission. And so the space to allow him to make paintings that help him explore his belief in God or his belief in what this world is about is not operative and not possible.
There's very little sense of wrestling. I mean, they're gorgeous paintings, but very little sense of wrestling. There is definitely a theology of glory there.
Absolutely. Good, true, and the beautiful, and that's what he's articulating. He may have wrestled in his private life in other avenues, but it's not in the painting studio. So one of the virtues, one of the interesting things about the history of modern art is that the studio space becomes a place where the artist takes material, painting materials, canvas, oil paint, smears it around on a surface, and that's coming out of an outgrowth of all of these issues that they're trying to figure out about who they are and how they relate to the world. So that's an important distinction that I think we as Christians often ignore. We want to think also that Renaissance and Baroque, the 15th and 16th century was a time also when everybody understood the arts, but that's not the case. Those works of art were made for particular people, a particular audience, and if a general audience had a relationship with them, they had a relationship with them because they went to church. They participated in mass and baptisms and the liturgies, and they saw the work that was there. But it wasn't as if that work itself spoke in a clear way to them that now modern artists are confusing and alienating the general audience. Mm. So art is a cultural practice that requires work and effort and practice to be able to hear and to be able to experience. So part of what art does is it frames a space for us to be attentive. So you go into a museum, you're now being trained to look at the world differently and focus on the artifacts and the objects there in a very attentive way. So it's a way of framing life. And so for an artist like Pollock, What is interesting, the randomness of these paintings, is that the paintings in many ways seem to be a consequence of his actions, of his gestures, of moving around the painting surface and pouring paint, taking place in the late 40s and in the early 50s. The concern for human freedom and spontaneity was a significant concern. And so to look at these monumental paintings of Pollock's drip paintings in the Metropolitan Museum or the Museum of Modern Art in New York, what you're looking at is action.
You know, we in the Christian tradition have always talked about, not just Christians, Plato talked about this, the good, the true, and the beautiful. But we tend to associate the good, the true, and the beautiful with, you know, the true is associated with explicitly true propositions. The good is associated with explicitly right actions, and the beautiful with explicitly attractive, even pretty, representations. So you think of, for example, with beauty, a kind of glorification of the beauty of the world in a sort of simplistic way, where everything glows, everything is bright and beautiful. How does modern art especially help us to think through our own Christian categories that make what we call beautiful a little more ambiguous?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of talk in terms of relating art to the Christian faith or art in relationship to the church operates on a 30,000-foot view, kind of a abstract. We talk about art in general, and we talk about the good and the true and the beautiful in general. But things begin to get a little more complicated when you're actually standing in front of a painting, for example, and just confronting the basic fundamental absurdity of it, that here a human being has devoted his or her life to smearing smelly pigments on a piece of canvas. And the belief, the confession of faith, and the fact that that amounts to something important, and that it amounts to something important enough to share with someone else generations, centuries later, is a remarkable thing. And it, in many ways, goes against what we think is valuable in the world. And it's a painting is just a wonderfully useless thing. And so just the fact that that practice itself goes against what we often think has value in the world. And it seems to me that a lot of talk in Christian circles about the good, the true, and the beautiful can participate too easily in this kind of instrumentalized view of what works for us. Perhaps a moralism, a prettiness, a familiarity, rather than the truth, the beauty, and the goodness that actually forces us to look behind what we're seeing or to not be fooled by what we're seeing. The glitzy and the powerful, there's something else behind that. And modern art certainly works to remind us of who we are. We are creatures. We're not godlike. We're creatures. We can celebrate our creaturehood. A good example in the history of modern art is with an artist like Paul Gauguin. Gauguin, in the mid to late 19th century, began to make figures that look like child drawings. And they look quite naive, and they look like he had no artistic talent. And Gauguin was very influential on artists like Pablo Picasso and others. And these artists were making childlike paintings. And it went against the kind of technical virtuosity and strength and beauty that academic painters in the 19th century were celebrating. And one of the reasons that these artists were doing it is that they wanted to return the charm of painting to the viewer. The charm of painting meaning, I mean, one of the reasons why we like children's drawings is that there's a certain innocence to it and a directness, and that the children don't have the technical tools to capture what they're seeing and what interests them. And so there's this tremendous gap between what the child wants to portray and then what he or she has the tools to portray. And there's something just wonderfully direct in its awkwardness. And modern artists who had been trained in the academy, who had all of this talent and technical virtuosity, wanted that, wanted the sense of directness, that painting could once again be part of this process of discovering something about the world, and wanted to return themselves to a kind of childlike innocence where their technical capacity couldn't quite capture. The world was too much of a mystery for them and too wonderful for them and too big for them to be able to capture with the tools that they had. So we look at a painting like that and we say, well, you know, my son or daughter could paint it. And they would say to you, that's right. That's right. This world is a mystery to me, and I can't stop looking at it, and I can't stop investigating it. And the tools that I had been trained to use as an academic painter don't do it for me. One of the criticisms of modern art is that it is believed that it was rejecting Renaissance and Baroque painting styles. And that's just not true. It came out of the academy. It came out of the boredom of a 19th century academic style that was too pretty.
Just adorning private homes and
decoration. You know. There was no sense of mystery in the world, that it was everything had already been figured out, and the focus was on the painter's capacity to be able to draw a fine and virtuous line. And so
ironically, it was actually, while we might think it's elitist and so forth, actually a reaction against an elitist kind of art, a return to the familiar and everyday.
That's right. In a sense that the viewer would go into the Salon, for example, in Paris in the mid-19th century and see references to current events and not just put aside the everyday life and go in and look at examples from biblical literature and classical mythology. Modern artists wanted to make paintings that connected to everyday life in some way and did something that would force the viewer not to leave all their troubles or their concerns or current events outside the exhibition space.
Now, with Gauguin, a lot of people will say, yeah, I get that. And I can even see, you know, his quote-unquote worldview at work there, the noble savage, the if we could only get back to a state of nature which the state of society has corrupted. Okay, now I'm on familiar ground, the world of ideas. Mm-hmm. And I can interpret a Gauguin painting. But how do I do that with abstract art? Abstract art seems so remote. It seems as different if it's all classed under modernism. Why does Gauguin seem so different from Kandinsky or Monrion?
Well, a painter like Kandinsky, he's interested in painting music. Painting for a number of artists in the late 19th century and early 20th century is an experiment in creating immediate experiences that they believed images of figures standing in a landscape or figures engaging in narrative subjects couldn't offer. And so what Kandinsky is doing is very much using the tool of painting, colors on a flat surface, but trying to create something to go around typical ways of creating an experience. So what is the experience that one has standing in front of a painting of Niagara Falls, for instance, and you have that experience, but part of that experience is because perhaps you've been there or you've seen other images and
associations.
The painter then, Kandinsky would suggest that painter is working from second or third remove. Hmm. What would happen if you could make a painting that would create that sense of awe and wonder with no previous experience? So that the painting itself becomes Niagara Falls, for example. So a critic had asked Jackson Pollock about his drip paintings and said, do you paint nature? And Pollock said, I don't paint nature. I am nature. And so the idea being the paintings that he made, he wanted to create this kind of awe-inspiring sense of standing in front of that painting as you would standing in front of a beautiful sunset without painting that sunset.
Interesting. What would be one big, hairy, audacious goal that Dan Seidel would have for Christians engaging culture generally, but the arts in particular?
I think the arts and artistic practices are a remarkable outgrowth of being children of God and a space that God has given us to live and breathe and delight in our creaturehood and delight in being bearers of God's image, and that particularly in my area, in modern art and those art forms that emerged in the 19th century, I'm interested in having as many people at least understand it and understand the artists as human beings. And working as a curator in a museum, I interacted with a lot of different audiences, with professional colleagues, with artists, and members of the general public. And the goal for me was always the same, just to open up space for understanding.
Well, we've been talking to Dan Seidel. If you want to read some terrific insights from Dan Seidel on these points and others, go to our website, whitehorsein.org, where Dan has written several blog posts for us, and hopefully we'll be reading more of his insights in the pages of Modern Reformation and on our blog. Dan, thanks a lot for helping us think through some of these really important issues.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.